Chapter 7.
This is ridiculous, I say,
looking in the minuscule mirror attached to the visor so I can make a last-minute adjustment to the swath of frothy pink fabric residing on the brim of my hat.
I look ridiculous.
Ryan turns the SUV onto a long gravel road, passing an open ornate gate with the words Hidden Hills Farm in metal letters stretched out across the top. He spares me a quick glance.
Yours won't even be the biggest hat there.
Are you sure? Because I totally think they're setting me up.
I agreed to go shopping with Sarah and Beth for the derby party, and they assured me this hat was exactly what I needed.
And it's not fair I have to tote this thing around on my head all day while you're in khakis and a button-down.
You look great, as always, he says.
Then pulls my hand away from the hat and brings it to his lips, where he places soft kisses against each finger. Moving in with Ryan has upped his romance game. Simple touches, sweet words, and gestures. Going out of his way to make sure I'm happy. When he's not at work, we're together. I can tell from his one-sided conversations with his friends that they are not pleased that I am monopolizing his time. A good girlfriend would insist he see his friends, make sure he didn't lose touch with the people he's closest to. But I am not a good girlfriend. Will your friends be mad we bailed on the pre-party? I ask as we get closer to our destination. We skipped drinks at Beth and Paul's, not because I couldn't stand the idea of being around Rachel, but because Ryan couldn't. He's still not over the way she acted at lunch. Although at this point, it's been blown up to a bigger deal than it really was. She pressed me for information, not punched me in the face. But in small towns, among small groups of friends, there is little difference between those two things. Ryan can hold a grudge.
I'm sure I'll hear something about it, but it's all good.
We've probably beat his friends here, so it will be interesting whom he gravitates to, since he's rarely at a function like this without his core group. When we pull up to the valet stand, I'm at least pleased to see that he was right. My hat is not the biggest or the most obnoxious, although that only means we all look like idiots. Our first stop is the bar.
Welcome to Hidden Hills Farms,
a woman behind the rough wood counter says.
Can I get your names before I get your cocktail?
While I think this request is unusual, Ryan doesn't hesitate.
Ryan and Evie.
The bartender nods and drops down behind the bar. I take a minute to look at the woman in line behind us, and I'm sure the plastic horse attached to her hat is the same one I got for Christmas when I was a kid. One of Barbie's horses, complete with pink saddle and bow in his mane. The bartender pops back up and starts making us a mint julep. I'm not sure if we have any other choice of beverage, since she never asked us what we wanted. But as I eye the healthy pour of Woodford, I'm not going to complain. When she's done, she hands us each a silver cup. Ryan's is engraved with an R, and mine has an E. Ryan and I walk away from the bar while I'm still studying the cup.
This is pretty over the top, I say.
I mean, if I said my name was Quinn, would she have pulled out a cup with a Q on it?
When I RSVP'd, I told them both our names. I have a whole collection of these at home. This one is number 6.
Ridiculous, I mutter while he laughs. We surf the crowd, and Ryan speaks to almost every person we pass, introducing me to them as his girlfriend while his arm anchors me to his side.
Well, hey, you two.
Ryan and I turn around to find his neighbor, Mrs. Rogers, heading our way. I get a pat on the arm from her, while Ryan is graced with a full frontal hug. I'm amazed at her ability to pull him in so close and not upset the precarious balance of the hat perched on her head.
Isn't this so fun?
So fun, I answer back. Before long, she wanders off to deliver more hugs, and Ryan gets into a deep conversation with a local judge about an upcoming election. So I take a moment to look around. This place is beautiful. The winding driveway was long enough that you can't see the main road or hear any traffic from the house, making it feel like this party is hidden from the rest of the world, just as its name suggests. The red wooden barn sits on top of a hill, and the pasture slopes down in all directions around it, like a sea of green lined with white fences.
There is a large movie theater-sized screen attached to the side of the barn, while smaller screens are scattered in between white linen tables that will show the race. Servers roam the crowd, bearing silver trays of many hot browns, individual portions of cheese grits, and delicate tea sandwiches. The judge ambles off, and Ryan jerks in surprise when a couple moves in close.
"Ryan!"
the man says, while flinging his arm around Ryan's neck and pulling him in tight. The two hug it out, while I study the woman with him. She's tall, close to my height, with long, light brown hair. She's slender but muscular, and I can't help but notice how physically similar we are. When Ryan breaks away, his friend holds out his hand in my direction.
"So you're the girl who's brought Ryan to his knees," the man says with a wide grin.
Ryan turns to me and says,
"Evie, this is an old friend of mine, James Bernard. James, this is my girlfriend, Evie Porter."
I place my hand in his and he shakes it enthusiastically. James is tall and thin, with the look of someone who struggles with substances. It's in the hollow places in his cheeks and the smudge of dark under his eyes, the tremor in his hands, and the clothes that are a tad too big. Nice dress clothes he probably dug out from the back of some closet just for today. His companion looks to be in better shape, and not just her clothes, but her general well-being. Her dress is a cream sleeveless shift that hits mid-thigh. The shoes are Italian and expensive, and the jewelry is simple but classy. They are a mismatched pair. "I'm not sure I've brought him to his knees quite yet, but I'm working on it," I tease. James turns to Ryan.
"Man, I'm so happy for you."
Ryan and I share a look. It's not like we're engaged, so this hearty congratulations seems a bit much.
"Thanks,"
Ryan says as he wraps his arm around me. We both look at the woman standing next to him, and Ryan nods in her direction.
"Introduce us to your friend."
James turns around quickly, obviously embarrassed he forgot who was standing next to him.
"Ryan, Evie, this is Luca Marino."
Her name runs through me like a shock of electricity. "Luca," I say quietly, rolling it around on my tongue. That's an unusual name. I realize I sound just like Beth on the night of the dinner party. She smiles and rolls her eyes. "I know. I'm named after the town in Italy where my grandparents were from. Two C's. No one ever spells it right." My eyes go to the silver cup in her hand. The script L is visible in the spaces between her fingers. James and Ryan start talking about who they bet on in the upcoming race. But I'm still stuck on the woman. "Are you from here?" I ask. My mouth is suddenly dry. I take a quick sip of my drink, but no more than that. "No, I'm from a small town in North Carolina, just above Greensboro. It's tiny. I'm sure you've never heard of it."
"Eden," I blurt out, before I can help myself.
She flinches slightly. Yeah, Eden. How did you? Just a lucky guess. I knew a girl in college who was from that area." I've got to pull it together. Dragging in a deep breath, I hold it a moment before letting it out in a soft rush of air. Twice more until I feel my heart rate start to slow. "Do you still have family there?" I ask once I feel centered. "No," she says with a frown. "It was just mom and me, but she passed away when I was in high school. Breast cancer." I had already noticed how similar we looked, but now my eyes devour her. I take stock of every inch of her so I can compare it to every inch of me. Both of us have hair that reaches to our mid-back and has a slight wave to it, but hers is lighter than mine, the color mine would normally be if I hadn't dyed it when I moved here. Eye color, same. Complexion, same. She notices my inspection and does one of her own. I feel her stare as it starts at my feet and runs straight up to the big, ridiculous hat. Is she surprised by how much we resemble each other? "Have you been to Eden?" she asks. "I have. The friend I mentioned brought a group of us to some festival. I think it was called something like Springfest. Is that right?" A test I need her to fail. A smile breaks out across her face, her eyebrows lifting. Y'all came to the Fall River Fest? It's always in September around my birthday. I love that festival.
No. No, no, no. I nod to her, then turn to Ryan. He's in deep conversation with James, but I interrupt him anyway.
Hey, I'm going to find the ladies' room. Be back in a moment.
Before he has a chance to say anything or offer to help me find the way, I'm gone. Walking fast in my tight black dress and 4-inch heels, I almost drop the metal cup with the letter E that is slick with condensation. I nearly fall onto a woman as I close in on the ridiculously nice portable bathroom station that was brought in for this event.
Oh, are you okay?
She asks, her hand on my arm as she steadies me. I nod, unable to speak. She shares a look of concern with her husband after I gently shake her off. Then they both watch me as I move away. It takes everything in me to hold it together until I'm in the privacy of one of the bathroom stalls, because I am freaking the fuck out. As soon as I'm inside and the lock is engaged, I slump against the door. I let out a silent scream and squeeze my eyes shut. This is not good. This is not good. This is not good. She is not from Eden, North Carolina. I am. Her mother didn't die from breast cancer. Mine did. Her name is not Luca Marino. Mine is. Luca Marino, 10 years ago. I inched the window open slowly. This afternoon when I tried it, it squeaked around the halfway mark, so I'm trying to stop it just before that point. When there's just enough space to slip inside, I go for it. The adrenaline rush never gets old. Dropping my backpack on the floor of the guest room, I quickly shuck the black leggings and carefully pull off the hoodie, making sure the wig cap stays in place and I don't smudge my makeup. Opening the bag, I pull out the sequined black cocktail dress and slip it on. It fits like a glove and is short enough that I'm likely to expose myself if I bend over. So it's perfect for what's happening here tonight. The long auburn wig is next. I flip it on, taking a few minutes to adjust it. I've practiced this enough in the dark to know when I get it right. Sky-high heels and a small black clutch finish the look. I shove my stuff under the bed, then quietly leave the room. The party is in full swing, and it's a short walk from the guest room to the center of the house. There's a band set up outside, and most of the food is spread out buffet style in the dining room, in addition to the past trays of oysters Rockefeller and mini lobster rolls that I saw being prepped in the kitchen when I was here earlier. My stomach rumbles, but I don't snatch one off the tray when it passes me. I can eat later. A woman stumbles into me, and I have to catch her before she takes us both down.
Oh, sweetie, I'm so sorry.
She slurs, clutching my arm for support. It's Mrs. Whittington, the second Mrs. Whittington and current wife of Mr. Whittington, not to be confused with the first Mrs. Whittington, who loves to bitch about the second one any chance she gets.
It's okay, I answer.
She eyes me up and down.
Love this dress. Where did you get it?
Oh, a little boutique I ran across while we were vacationing in Virginia Beach, I answer, my accent completely gone.
That took more practice than putting on the wig in the dark. I wait for recognition to cross her face, but in these clothes, with this hair and the contoured makeup and smoky eyes, there is no part of me that is recognizable. It doesn't hurt that no one expects the poor little girl who works in the back room of the local flower shop to rub elbows with high society as they throw massive parties to celebrate the engagement of a couple whose marriage won't last 2 years. Honestly, these two will be lucky to make it down the aisle. Once Mrs. Whittington is steady on her feet, or as steady as she can be in her current condition, I move past her. I would have had trouble coming in through the front door since the parents of the bride and groom are greeting everyone who arrives, but no one will question me now that I'm inside the party. I pick my way through the open floor plan to a hallway on the other side of the massive den. I don't usually have to make an appearance, but the way this house is laid out left me no other options. The band is literally set up in front of the owner's bedroom windows outside, so through the inside door I must go. I linger near the opening of the hall that will lead me to the Albertons' master suite. With my phone in my hand, I'm the image of someone who is looking for a quiet corner to make a call. My eyes are everywhere but the phone as I gauge the level of interest the other guests have in me. My other hand is in my clutch, my fingers wrapped around a device hidden inside. I take a deep breath, then push the small button. A loud crashing sound makes everyone turn in the direction of the kitchen, and I slip down the hall unnoticed into the bedroom. Someone may search for the source of that crash, but they won't find anything out of place. The room is dark, but it takes no time to get to the bathroom. I slip on the pair of black gloves from my clutch, then open the drawer in the built-in dressing table, searching for the heart-shaped box I know is tucked inside. I find it. Then I pick through the box's offerings and pull out the sapphire ring, a pair of emerald earrings, and a necklace with a decent-sized amethyst surrounded by some channel-set diamonds. I wish the diamond earrings and pendant Mrs. Alberton wore into the store last week were here, but I'm sure she's wearing them right now. I drop the treasures in my bag, followed by the gloves, then retrace my steps. This is a moment when the fear of being caught threatens to choke me, but I push past it and turn the corner into the main room, like I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. Thankfully, no one is paying me any attention. I take my time heading back to the guest room, even stopping long enough to snag one of those lobster rolls. It is as yummy as I hoped it would be. I'm pulling off the dress as I reach for the backpack hidden under the bed, then shuck the heels. Within seconds, I'm in my leggings and hoodie, and I'm slipping out the window.
Mama, I'm back,
I yell as I step inside our trailer. My southern drawl snaps into place the second I cross the threshold.
Hey, honey, who won the game?
Mama asks from her bedroom. My light brown hair is free of the wig cap, and my face is scrubbed clean of makeup. The black hoodie has been replaced with one depicting my high school's name and mascot. Carrying a brown paper bag, I close the short distance from the main living area to Mama's room. I drop it on the TV tray on the side of her bed before crawling in next to her.
We lost, but it was close, I say.
Mama digs in the bag, and a smile breaks out across her face.
Oh, sweetie, you shouldn't have.
Cinnamon wafts through the room, and my heart nearly bursts seeing this small moment of happiness over something as simple as a late-night treat.
You need to eat more, Mama. You're getting too skinny.
Mama unwraps the bakery paper, and the big, fat cinnamon roll looks as decadent as it smells.
My favorite, she whispers.
I know, I whisper back. While she takes small bites, I pick up one of the square pieces of paper from the stack on the bedside table and start folding it in the way she's taught me. Mama watches me while she eats, not correcting me when I make a wrong fold, instead letting me find my mistake on my own. After several minutes, the small white origami swan takes shape in my hand.
Oh, that's a pretty one, she says,
plucking it out of the palm of my hand and adding it to the collection on the built-in shelf in her headboard. There are lots of different paper animals in all colors and sizes, standing like sentries guarding over her. Mama has always been good with her hands, but no matter how many times she shows me, the swan is the only one I've mastered. She's about half done with the cinnamon roll when she's wrapping it back up and putting it on the table next to the bed.
I'll finish the rest tomorrow, she says.
Even though we both know she won't. It's amazing she ate as much as she did.
What are your plans for the rest of the weekend? She asks as she snuggles back down in the bed.
I'm working at the flower shop. Big wedding tomorrow night. She turns her head toward me, her frail hand reaching out to my face.
You work too much. It's your senior year. You should be out with your friends, having fun.
I shake my head and swallow down the huge lump in my throat. I can do both. I lie, and we both let me get away with it.
Have you heard back from any of the colleges you applied for yet? Mama asks.
I shake my head.
Not yet,
but should be any day now. I can't tell her I never applied because we couldn't spare the application fee. And as much as I don't want to admit it, she probably won't be here to see I'm still stuck in this small town come fall. I know they're all gonna want you. You'll have your pick. I nod along, but don't say anything. But then she's leaning closer and clutching my hand. One day soon, you'll be all grown. She lets out a laugh and adds, what am I saying? You're already there, taking care of me and everything else. I want so much for you, Luca. A home and a family of your own one day. I want you to have that house we've always dreamed of. Maybe you can build it in that fancy new neighborhood near the lake. And I'll have a room just for you, I add, playing along with the fantasy. We'll paint it green since it's your favorite, and you can get one of those beds that has a canopy on top. We can plant a garden in the backyard. She reaches up and pushes a stray clump of hair out of my face, then tucks it behind my ear. We'll grow tomatoes and cucumbers. And carrots. Her eyelids get heavy. I know she's only seconds from slipping back into sleep, even though she's probably slept all day. Of course. Carrots. They're your favorite. And I'll make you a carrot cake. She falls asleep, and I lean over to kiss her cheek, trying not to panic over how cool her skin feels. I add another blanket to the mountain she's already burrowed under before scooting out of the bed. I head straight for the tiny room at the front of our trailer that is nothing more than a large closet, but it's like stepping into another world when I pass through the door. Before cancer ravaged her body, Mama spent every day in this room behind her sewing machine and craft table. Mothers came from all over North Carolina to have her make pageant dresses, prom dresses, and even the occasional wedding dress for their daughters. When I was little, I'd sit at Mama's feet and watch these plain girls walk in and then somehow be transformed once she got her hands on them. It was in that moment that I learned you can become someone else with the right hair, the right dress, and the right accessories. Bolts of fabric and rolls of ribbon are stacked against one wall, while the particle board shelving behind the sewing machine holds jars stuffed full of feathers and rhinestones and any other trimming you could imagine. When Mama first got sick, I took over her orders. I'd been helping her in this room for as long as I can remember, so it wasn't a big leap. But pageant dresses and custom-made costume jewelry didn't bring in enough money to get Mama the treatments she needed or pay for all the medication she was on. So I had to get creative. The job opening at the flower shop in nearby Greensboro was just the answer. Women love coming in the shop decked out in their best jewelry. They love talking about the parties they're hosting and the impressive guest list of those invited. And of course, they need us to deliver the arrangements and make sure everything is just right. With so much pre-party commotion, it's easy to slip in a forgotten room and unlatch a window. The key is not to take something when I'm there delivering flowers. That brings too much suspicion on the small group who were there early in the day. It's better to let the missus get dressed for the party. Let her pick through her jewelry to decide what will look best. Make sure she remembers what was left in that little jewelry box before the party kicks off. And then, when the house is bursting with guests and valet and waitstaff and bartenders, the forgotten flower shop girl has a chance to slip back in and grab the pieces that didn't get chosen for the night. The police will inevitably ask when the last time Mrs. Alberton saw these three pieces was, and she will say it was just before the party started, therefore taking the flower delivery people out of the running of possible suspects. I also learned that it would be best to keep that version of me separate from the real version. Luca Marino is a 17-year-old high school senior who sews dresses and makes costume jewelry to help her mother pay the bills. The girl at the flower store has different hair, different makeup, and answers to a different name. It takes some time to pry the stones from their settings before I can drop the gold into a small melting pot. Next week, I'll drive in the opposite direction, crossing into Virginia, to get rid of the stones and gold. No one ever recognizes their stones once they're free of their settings. It's a lot of risk for a couple $100, but we need every penny we can get. I've learned you've got to target the exact right woman. She's well off enough that she hires a professional florist to decorate for her party and has a few nice pieces of jewelry that she feels comfortable enough to shove into a bathroom drawer. but not so well off that there's a safe to crack or a security system to disarm. I work carefully, looking at each piece through an LED magnifying lamp. It's slow work prying each prong off without damaging the stone. Mama would have had this done in minutes. Well, not really. She'd beat my ass if she knew what I was using her tools for. I had to decide a long time ago that what she doesn't know can't hurt her. I finish up just before midnight. I still have a paper to write, and Mama needs another dose of her meds before I can crawl into bed, putting the tools away and cutting off the light. I'm already thinking about the wedding tomorrow night. Chapter 8. Present Day. It takes 10 minutes to get myself under control. Panicking was a dumb move, and one I hope I don't end up regretting. I should not have walked away from her. I should have discovered whether her knowledge was just of Eden and the general events of my life, or whether she knew deeper things, the things only a handful of people could have told her. I should have pushed her more, found the hole in her story and smashed it open. I should have seen this coming. It's been a long time since I've been blindsided. Ryan is scanning the crowd for a sign of me when I leave the bathroom. He's still in the same place I left him, probably thinking that it would make it easier for me to find him if he stayed put. But James and the woman with him are long gone. Ryan pulls me close the second I reach him, his arms sliding around my waist.
"Are you okay?"
he asks.
"You look pale."
The woman's appearance here is concerning, but I don't know exactly how just yet. It's easy to jump to conclusions and assume this has something to do with my last job, but it's a mistake not to consider any and all other options as well. I've made a lot of enemies over the last 10 years, but people you trust can turn on you just as easily. I remind myself, I only deal in facts. Nodding, I clear my throat. "Yes, all good. That drink went straight to my head." He seems relieved that my predicament has an easy remedy and pulls me to the buffet table and loads a plate of food for me. Ryan finds 2 open spots at a white linen-covered table and sets the plate between us.
"If you don't feel better after eating some of this, we can leave."
But there's no way I'm leaving until I have another crack at that woman. I pick through the offerings on the plate, nibbling on a finger sandwich, while Ryan signals to a passing waiter for a bottle of water. Deep breaths. I need to get back on my game.
"It looks like it's been a long time since you've seen your friend James," I say.
"Yeah, God, probably 2 years. We were close as kids. He didn't move back after college."
He frowns.
"Things have been tough for him. Said he's in town because his dad fell and broke his leg. Sounds like he'll be here for a while, helping his mom take care of him."
"Maybe we can have them over for dinner while he's here. Give you 2 a chance to catch up." He shrugs.
"Yeah, maybe."
I want to ask about the girl, what he knows about her, if he knows anything about her, if there was anything he learned after I ran off to the bathroom. But that's so unlike me. This me I've created doesn't pry, doesn't ask unnecessary questions, doesn't push for information about his friends or their companions. I need the moments that include James and his date to be buried in the blur of the day and not become the chunk of time that separates itself and becomes its own memory. Because that's all it would take. It's been said that if you want a slice of time to stick out, to be crystal clear in your mind, one small difference in an otherwise normal routine is all it takes. Like if you're the type who has trouble remembering whether you locked your front door before leaving for vacation, you should separate it from all the other perfunctory times you've locked your front door. Something as simple as turning around in a circle just before you slip the key in the lock would do it. A simple movement, and forever that memory will be burned into your mind. It becomes clear enough to play over and over again. You see the door, the key turning, the doorknob wobbling when you tested the lock. And there's no guessing whether or not you did it, because you know you did. I don't need Ryan analyzing this moment later, wondering why I had such an interest in his old friend and the woman from North Carolina. Why I actively wanted to hunt them down so that we could spend more time with them. I don't need these questions to be the turn before locking the door. There are a lot of people here, but not so many that we shouldn't bump into them again before it's over. For now, I'll bide my time and run through every scenario that might make this make sense.
That hat looks fabulous on you,
Sarah squeals as she approaches the table. I tilt my head from side to side, the hat bobbling along with me.
Yours too,
I say back enthusiastically. The rest of Ryan's friend group arrives shortly after her. And from the glassy looks to the pink cheeks, I'd say drinks before was a success. Ryan stands up from the table, greeting his closest friends with a handshake and a firm grip on the shoulder. If they have any issues with us bailing on the pre-party, they don't show it. The guys form a tight circle a few feet away, while Sarah drops down in Ryan's vacated chair. Beth and Allison pull up ones from a nearby table, but Rachel remains standing a few feet away. Allison scoots to the edge of her chair, then beckons Rachel over.
Here, put a cheek down and we'll share this one.
Maybe Rachel was hesitant because there wasn't an open chair. But I think she was torn because she'd rather hang with the boys. Once everyone is settled, Beth leans in and says, I would be so pissed if I showed up wearing the same hat as three other women here. She must be talking about the one with the peacock feathers shooting out of the top and falling like a curtain down the back until they almost touch the ground. I've seen three of those already. Sarah takes a sip from her silver cup.
That's why you have to shop at Martha's. She keeps track of every hat sold and doesn't duplicate, and never offers the same hats the next year in case someone decides to pull from the archives.
Then she nods toward Allison.
Or have the florist make you one.
Allison's hat is more like a blanket of red roses, fresh ones, it seems, just like the blanket of roses that will cover the winning horse. I can't help the snort of laughter that slips past my lips. These hats are serious business. Judging by the roll of her eyes and the shake of her head, Rachel seems to be the only one who agrees this party is ridiculous. They continue to break down everyone here, and I realize I can use this to my advantage. If James Bernard was an old friend of Ryan's, then he was an old friend of theirs, too. I just need an opening.
Oh, Allison squeaks. Can you believe Gianna Kilburn had the nerve to show her face here?
Where is she? Beth asks. Allison points to a short, round, blonde woman nearby who is wearing way too much jewelry. She's hammered. I noticed her earlier when she was walking from the buffet line to a table and almost wobbled right off those high heels of hers.
I swear, I'll never understand men, Sarah says. If they're going to cheat, why do it with someone as tragic as Gianna?
Once they've just finished speculating who Gianna's next victim will be, I say, Ryan ran into an old friend he hasn't seen in years, James Bernard. He seemed excited to see him. All four women whipped their heads in my direction.
He's here?
Beth asks, her mouth hanging slightly open as if she's in awe of my news. I nod and survey the rest of them and find they all are exhibiting varying degrees of shock and confusion. Except Rachel. This is not news to Rachel. He's here with a woman. I don't say her name. I can't bring myself to say her name. My name. Allison, Beth, and Sarah all turn around and scan the crowd, hoping for a glimpse of them. But Rachel looks at me. Beth swings back around and says,
I can't believe he'd show up here. He must need money.
I take a slow drink from my cup, like I've got all the time in the world, before lowering it, then ask,
why do you say that?
My calm and controlled outer shell that is usually locked down tight quivers and threatens to crumble in a million pieces.
He's trouble, Allison adds. Nearly bankrupted his parents with his gambling. They bailed him out more times than they should have. No one knows where he's even been the last few years.
How did he look? Bad? Beth asks. I bet he looked bad. And honestly, I'm shocked he found a date. She must be a train wreck, too.
I don't mention that his date was far from a train wreck.
I'm surprised he had the nerve to talk to Ryan, Sarah says.
As casually as I can, I ask, Why? Allison answers for her instead.
Ryan tried to help him out a year ago, gave him a job, set him up with a place to live, everything. James screwed him over so bad, stole some money from him or something. Ryan was super pissed.
Yeah, but we all know if anyone is going to forgive him, it's Ryan.
Wonder who the girl is.
Sarah rattles the ice around in her empty cup. A few more of those, and Ray will be carrying her out of here. I'm even more worried now. James's return isn't welcome, and his appearance here, with her, concerns me. I need to consider the possibility that the woman with my name and my background is using James to get close to me. Rachel is quiet, enough so that I'm sure she could answer every question they have. One for the honey, the long shot, won the race more than an hour ago, and Ryan has been on cloud nine since he won a nice chunk of change on him. We've circled the crowd several times, but we haven't run across James and the woman again. And from the girls' talk, they haven't seen him either. My mentioning him and his companion whetted their appetite, and they were greedy for a look at them both. Ryan leans in close and whispers in my ear,
"You know, the best way to spend these winnings would be to head straight for the airport and not stop until we're on a beach in Mexico somewhere."
I turn to face him, wrapping Ryan's tie around my right hand and pulling him close.
"I like the sound of that."
The words come out in a purr as I step closer so we're touching from top to bottom. Evie Porter has a lot of things, but a passport isn't one of them. Ryan has refilled his silver monogram cup several times, and I don't think there is any danger these plans would become a reality. Plus, he would never leave without making arrangements at work first. It's fun to play along, though. More importantly, a girlfriend like me wouldn't hesitate to escape to the beach.
"I've been dreaming about you in that pink bikini you unpacked last week."
His head dips until his lips are pressed against the side of my neck. We're very close to causing a scene, because this is not the type of party where PDA goes unnoticed. This is the first time I've seen him drink this much. He's a happy drunk, handsy. His feelings for me stretch across his beautiful face like an open book, and everyone here gets a peek. "We don't have to be on the beach for me to show you that pink bikini." A quick glance around our immediate area tells me we're already the subject of several whispered conversations. We linger like this a few more minutes, because my goal today was to solidify myself as Ryan's girlfriend, and all anyone will talk about was how he was all over me. But now that it seems like James and the woman are gone, I'm ready to leave too. The sooner I can get out of here, the sooner I can figure out what is going on. "You get the valet to pull your car around, and I'll drive us home," I say, loosening my grip on his tie and stepping back from him. Ryan leans in for a kiss, and I don't resist him. It's slow and sweet, the kind of kiss that makes you want more. And wanting more is dangerous. I give myself 30 seconds to live in the world where this is real, where my boyfriend is declaring his affection for me in front of all these people, and there's nothing to stop this relationship from continuing indefinitely, where there is no question about who I really am or what my motives are. But too soon, time is up. "Everyone is staring at us," I whisper against his lips. Ryan keeps his eyes on me.
"Good."
Then he pulls me toward the valet stand while digging in his pocket with his free hand for some tip money and the ticket to claim his car. His friends are scattered around the party, and neither of us make any effort to say goodbye. I throw my heels and hat in the back seat as soon as I'm behind the wheel, then scoot the seat up. Ryan reclines his seat back, just enough that he's still upright, but barely. His eyes close as he begins to hum along with the song playing on the radio. I like seeing him like this. On a normal day, he can be wound up pretty tight and a bit grumpy if there's a problem at work. But now he's relaxed, loose. There's that part of me I hate when my next thoughts wander to what I can find out from him while his guard is down. How many secrets can I pry out of those loose lips? His hand reaches across the space separating us. His finger is tangling with mine.
"Luca," he says,
and that single word punctures my lungs, making it hard to drag in a breath. My hand on the steering wheel grips tight, and it's the only thing that stops this car from flying off the road and landing in the ditch. Before my brain can come up with any words, he says,
"That girl with James."
His eyes are still closed, so he doesn't witness my silent hysteria.
"She said something weird after you went to the bathroom."
Fuck. Fuck, fuck, fuck. Deep breath in through my nose, slow and steady out of my mouth. Two more times.
"What did she say?"
I ask in what I hope is a bored voice.
"Just before they walked away, she said James was hoping to reconnect with me, but said it so he wouldn't hear her. Says she'd love to get to know you, too."
That bitch. "Huh," I say. "Why is that weird?"
"The last time I saw him, things were strained. I've learned to be cautious where James is concerned,"
he says with a grumble.
"She seems nice enough, though. Too good for him."
I'm fuming. Still open to all options as to why she's here. But there's no way this is some sort of crazy coincidence. Ryan turns on his side, his cheek resting on the seat, his eyes on me.
"I'm not bailing him out again. Nope. I'm done. He's her problem now."
I drag our joined hands into my lap, squeezing gently. He smiles a loopy smile, and I'm hoping this entire conversation is fuzzy tomorrow. You like that bikini, huh? I untangle my fingers from his, but keep his hand on my thigh. He perks up, his eyes sweeping from my face down my body. I slide his hand under the hem of my dress, dragging his fingers against the lace top of my thigh highs. His eyes get big, surprised to find what I'm hiding underneath. But he wastes no time latching on to the straps holding them up. Not many women wear stockings anymore, and I agree they were invented by the devil. But I've yet to find a man who could resist the garters. And you never know when you'll need a guaranteed distraction. And what I need more than anything right now is to ensure that when Ryan thinks back to this car ride home, the memory that crystallizes clearer than all the others will not include Luca Marino. Chapter 9. Present Day. I hate coming here during off hours, but after yesterday, this visit couldn't wait. The UPS store is closed to the public on Sunday mornings, so I enter my code on the keypad to gain entrance, then make my way to the back as quickly as possible. As much as I try to predict what everyone will do, the one thing that is completely unpredictable is what I will find in the mailbox. Every job is different, and the only way my boss can control the job, and me, is by keeping me in the dark as long as possible. I'm fed just enough to move forward, but not so much that I can get ahead or change the game. And of course, I'm never told who the client is because, you know, control. The first piece of information I get is the location. I learn everything there is to know about the town where I'll be sent. The name of the mark comes next. I'm one of those lucky people who read something once and it's forever filed away in one of those deep corners of my brain. Because of that, it's easy to recall the typed piece of paper that introduced me to Ryan. Subject: Ryan Sumner. Ryan is a 30-year-old single white male who resides at 378 Birch Drive, Lake Forbing, Louisiana. At 22, he graduated from LSU with a degree in business and a minor in finance, then passed the Series 7 exam 6 months post-graduation, and currently works as a financial planner. Early life. Ryan has one sister, Natalie, who is 3 years older. Father Scott Sumner was involved in a vehicular accident and died from his injuries when Ryan was 10 years old. Ryan's mother, Meredith Sumner, now Meredith Donaldson, remarried within a year. Ryan moved in with his paternal grandparents, Ingrid and William Sumner, when he was 12, due to his inability to get along with his new stepfather. Ingrid passed away 6 years ago from a short battle with cancer, William passed away a year later from a brain aneurysm that burst while he was at home in his bed. Ryan was the one to find him. Grandparents left house and furnishings to Ryan, and monetary assets were split between Ryan and Natalie. Ryan currently resides in the grandparents' house. That house was a sanctuary for him, so tread lightly there. If Ryan feels secure bringing you into his home, you're set. Ryan's dating history suggests he is heterosexual. His longest relationship was with a woman named Courtney Banning during his sophomore and junior year at LSU. The relationship terminated when Courtney left to spend her senior year studying abroad in Italy. When Ryan moved back to Lake Forbing, he rekindled his relationship with high school sweetheart Amelia Rodriguez, but it only lasted 5 months. Since then, Ryan has dated in a casual manner, mostly when he needs a plus one for social or work events. Some female companionship results from chance meetings in a bar or nightclub, but those are one-time events that do not repeat. Do not recommend initiating contact in that environment. Ryan is part of an extremely close-knit friend group and will go out of his way to help them. Friends find him highly trustworthy and dependable. Damsel in distress seems the best approach. I ate, slept, and breathed everything Ryan in the weeks before we met. Watched the highlights from his high school football games, stalked his family's social media accounts, and watched hours and hours of daily comings and goings, both in person and from video surveillance. And damsel in distress was absolutely the right approach. After the location, I'm given the identity I will use for the job. A name, a backstory, all carefully crafted with the supporting documentation I will need to sell it. I had studied the pictures of Courtney and Amelia that were included in the report. Both have long dark hair, so for this job, Evie Porter would have the same style and shade. But that's where the similarities would end. Because while Ryan may have a certain type he's attracted to, neither of those relationships lasted. Evie would dress to stand out, to be remembered. Her style would be a little bit bohemian, a little bit hippie. Minimal makeup, but lots of necklaces and bracelets. Just the thing a preppy golden boy needs to shake things up. The last piece of the puzzle I get is the job. Sometimes the jobs are short, lasting a few days to a week, a quick in and out. Other times it's much longer, a couple of months or more. I was told I might be in this identity for a while. Ryan's work in East Texas plays a critical role in this job, and getting the information I need would not be easy. Because my boss isn't happy with how my last job ended, I'm on very thin ice. 6 months ago, I was sent to retrieve some extremely sensitive information that was being used as blackmail against one of my boss's longtime clients. And when that client is Victor Connolly, head of one of the largest crime families in the Northeast, failure is not an option. But I failed to retrieve it. Perfection is crucial on this one. Second chances in this line of work are extremely rare. I knew my boss would be testing me on this job. He had to determine whether I was still one of his best assets or whether I'd become his biggest liability. I expected this job to be challenging, but I never expected her. Luca. Her arrival changes everything, which is why I'm checking the mailbox on a Sunday. Luckily, it's raining, so I keep the black raincoat cinched tight with the hood up. Droplets slide off and litter the floor with every step, until I'm standing in front of box 1428. A deep breath, and then I key in the number, swing the door open. I stare at the empty space while water soaks the carpet in front of me. Pushing the door closed, I re-enter the code to lock it. Once I'm back in my car, I think about how I should proceed. I was taught it was reckless not to consider every single possibility when on a job. But my gut is telling me that woman was sent here by the same people who sent me. And as Mama used to say, better the devil you know. There is a number I can call to relay this latest development, but I've been told over and over that using it should be a last resort. It's one step before needing to be pulled out of a job, or if your cover has been blown. It's admitting defeat, or worse, that you got caught. My boss failed to mention the protocol when faced with an imposter using your true identity, though. I am in uncharted territory. Luca Marino, 8 years ago. The bidding for the trip to Mexico is up to $12,000. I know they all say it's for a good cause, but you've got to be high to pay over $10,000 for a trip that's worth $2,000 at best. I'm just glad everyone here has the credit limit to be so generous. I hold my empty tray just above my shoulder and wander through the ballroom. It's another Saturday night in Raleigh, and yet another fundraiser where hundreds of items are being auctioned off. Tonight, these tux and ball gown clad people are here to support the local opera guild. A man in his 50s appears in front of me, and he stares at my chest a lot longer than necessary if he's just trying to read the name on my name tag.
Susan, any chance I can get a Macallan on Ice?
He asks. Sure thing, Mr. Fuller. What's your member number? He's not surprised that I knew his name, and he rattles off the 5 digits, even though I already know it. I take 2 more orders before I get to the bar, then spend the next 10 minutes hunting each member down to deliver their drink. Some patrons I recognize as regulars. They are here for some function or another every weekend. But quite a few are new to me. I've had this gig for a few months, and it's been more financially beneficial than I thought it would be. Earlier today, after everything was set up and ready to go for tonight, I added a scanner to one of the credit card machines. When the guests pay for the overpriced items they bought, I'll get a copy of every credit card name, number, and expiration date. The scanner was expensive, and I'm hoping after tonight, I'll be able to afford an additional one. The trick is to hold on to that data for a bit. It won't do me any good if the club is alerted by a bunch of members that their credit card was stolen tonight, and then they look closer into who was here. As Mama used to say, the pig gets fat, but the hog gets slaughtered. No, I'll use those credit cards here and there in small increments a few weeks from now. Not enough to raise a flag or question the transaction right away. With so many numbers at my disposal, those insignificant amounts add up pretty quick.
The all-inclusive trip for four to Cabo is sold to Mrs. Rollins for $13,500,
the MC announces over the mic, then slams the gavel down on the podium. Cheers erupt through the crowd. Yeah, not gonna feel bad about this one. The band cranks up as soon as the last auction item is sold. The line to check out wraps along the back wall of the ballroom, and the waitstaff jump into action so that any member stuck waiting in line doesn't want for anything. I even hold a few places while they excuse themselves to go to the restroom. As the evening starts to wind down, I stick close to the organizer's table so I can retrieve the scanner. Can I be of service? I ask the woman in charge as her team starts breaking down their area. Yes, we could use all the help we can get, she says, a little overexcited. She reaches over and squeezes my arm in what is probably meant to be a thank God you're here way. But I get a ping in my gut that makes me straighten my spine and survey the scene with a critical eye. Something feels off. I start loading the leftover programs into boxes, then stack them on the cart they will use to transport everything to the parking lot while I keep an eye on everyone else. It seems the same as any other weekend, and I swallow my apprehension, waiting until they are distracted. I move to the credit card machine and pick it up quickly, popping the scanner out in one swift move.
What's in your hand?
A voice behind me asks. A cold chill settles over me. Spinning around, I hold both hands out, the machine in one and the small scanner piece in the other. I'm so sorry. You can take it out of my pay. I didn't realize how fragile it was when I picked it up. I offer both pieces to my manager, then look him in the eye. I can tell he's a little thrown for a second or two, but then seems to pull himself back together.
You can cut the wide-eyed innocent look. We know what you've done. Stealing from our members and their guests.
Mr. Sullivan yanks the pieces out of my hands and thrusts them toward the pair of uniformed officers who have appeared at his side. But neither officer takes the device. The one closest to him offers a big plastic bag for Mr. Sullivan to drop the evidence into instead. My forehead is creased in confusion. My lower jaw hangs open just enough. There are a few members still loitering around the room, and my interaction with the cops has caught their attention, which causes them to move closer. My mind is racing. I'm thinking about my laptop and modem hiding under the dessert table, just a few feet away from where we're standing. The cleaning crew is only minutes away from pulling the tablecloth off and exposing it. I hold both my hands up, palms out toward Mr. Sullivan.
Wait, you think I've been stealing from people? With that black plastic thing?
My voice is soft and breaks on a few words, as if I'm too choked up to get them out whole. I turn toward the officers, reading their name badges quickly.
Officer Ford, I was only trying to help clean up.
Tears gather in my eyes until a big, fat one spills over. I just need a moment to grab my stuff and get out of here. I can't let them take me in. I'm employed under a fake name and social security number that won't hold up under any type of scrutiny. I need to disappear. Mr. Sullivan turns to Officer Williams, since Officer Ford seems like he's willing to believe me.
I want her out of here, now.
Williams nods, but pulls a small notebook from his back pocket.
Of course, but I'm going to have to get a little information before we go.
He points to a chair beside the table and indicates that I should take a seat. I consider running for about 3 seconds, but without my laptop, I won't get far. I settle in and scan the room, taking in every face still present, while Williams speaks with the organizers and Ford stands next to him.
Can you tell me how you determined there was a problem with one of the machines?
Williams asks the woman who squeezed my arm earlier.
Of course,
she says, beaming. We ran a card earlier in the evening, and when we pulled it out, we noticed that black piece came out with the card. After looking at the other machines, we discovered it was an addition made only to this machine, and that made us question what it was. We brought it to the attention of Mr. Sullivan, and we determined it was one of those scanner things. We didn't use that machine again. He's writing everything down.
Can you tell me which one of you was working the machine in question?
A short blonde woman nearby raises her hand.
It was me,
she says, then throws me an apologetic look, like she feels bad she played a part in my getting busted. Williams takes her name and asks question after question. Mr. Sullivan finally interrupts Williams's questioning.
You should know all of this. The police sent you here so you could wait and watch to see if the perpetrator would try to retrieve that device.
It's been about 30 minutes since he first caught me, and the members still present are circling closer. It's clear he wants me gone from this room before they butt in.
We want to press charges, and I'd like her removed from the property immediately.
Excuse me. Someone left their stuff under the table.
One of the guys on the cleanup crew is standing not far away, holding a rolled-up tablecloth in one hand and pointing to the floor with the other. My equipment has been discovered. The laptop is password-protected, so they won't be able to get in. But if they take it from me, I lose everything. The woman in charge walks closer to look at it, then turns toward the cops.
It's not ours.
Ford moves toward the table, and using napkins so he doesn't touch it directly, he picks up both the computer and modem. He looks at me and asks,
I'm guessing this is yours.
I ignore him. He puts both into a box one of the organizers provided. They take my backpack, retrieved from the break room too.
Get her out of here,
Mr. Sullivan says, his voice full of disgust. Williams pulls me up from the chair, then turns me to face the room.
Give me your hands.
He cuffs me while reading me my rights. My head hangs as Williams ushers me out, and Ford follows behind us, carrying all my gear. I'm so mad at myself, mad for getting caught, mad for not listening when my gut was trying to tell me something felt off. We're out in the parking lot next to the cop car, and Ford puts the box down on the ground so we can dig out his keys. As soon as the car is unlocked, Williams opens the back door and motions me forward.
I guess you have to take me in,
I say. Not really a question. At least he looks less than enthusiastic when he replies,
Yeah, I do. But if this is your first offense, there's a good chance they'll be easy on you.
Ford moves to put the box of my stuff in the trunk, just as an older man in slacks and a cheap brown jacket approaches us.
Williams,
he calls out, and the officer turns in his direction just before he can stuff me inside the car.
Detective Sanders,
Officer Williams says in a surprised voice.
Did they call you in for this?
The detective looks me over, then turns his attention to Williams.
Yeah, some bigwig in there is worried about his credit card information, blah, 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 and called the captain. Told me to hustle on down here and handle it so we don't hear shit later.
His arms are stretched out, and he clearly wants Ford to hand him the box with my laptop, modem, and backpack, which he does with little resistance. Officer Williams nods at me.
Want me to take her in, or is she with you?
With me,
he says.
Uncuff her. I'll secure her with my set.
Within seconds, I'm free, only to be handed over to the new guy. He towers over me.
Can you walk with me to my car without causing a problem? Or do I need to put the cuffs back on you right now?
I'll cooperate, I say. The officers get back in the patrol car and drive away just as we approach his unmarked vehicle. He puts the box in his back seat, then turns to me, a small phone in one hand and my backpack in the other.
Call the number in that phone and do what he says, and you'll get your stuff back.
When I don't take either immediately, he shakes the phone around in the air in front of me.
I wouldn't pass this offer up. You won't be getting another one.
I snatch both and stare at him. You're letting me go? He moves to the driver's door without a word. I stand frozen in place until his taillights fade away in the darkness. Noise from the front door of the club spurs me into action. The crowd is dissipating now that the excitement is over. I run for my car and pull my keys from my bag. The phone is on the passenger seat, but I don't touch it until I'm pulling up at the garage apartment I've been living in. Racing inside, I throw my backpack on the small kitchen table, then take the phone to my bed. There is one contact listed. Mr. Smith. I press the contact name and hit send. I was told to call this number, I say as soon as it connects.
We've been watching you.
The mechanical voice catches me off guard, and I almost drop the phone. He's using one of those voice changer devices.
First in Greensboro, now in Raleigh. Sorry to hear about your mother's passing.
I go cold inside. There's no way anyone should be able to connect the girl in this apartment to the one from the trailer park in Eden. I've made sure of that. Or so I thought I had. Why?
You were able to take something you shouldn't have had access to. It took us some time and resources to find out it was you. I'm hard to impress, but somehow you did just that.
Oh, shit. Even though I am freaking out inside, I take a few breaths to calm myself. It didn't take long for me to graduate from the simple pieces of jewelry to paintings, silver, antiques, anything I could get my hands on, as long as it was small enough for me to carry on my own. And when you dig deep enough on the internet, you can find a willing buyer for anything. Do you need it back? I ask.
We've already retrieved the item.
This is even worse somehow.
You've found yourself in a bit of trouble, though. Bad piece of luck your equipment gave you up like that. I might not have been able to get you out of trouble if you had made it to the station.
I lie back on my bed and stare at the ceiling. This feels surreal, and I don't know how to process it. No one has watched out for me since before Mama got sick. But I didn't think my guardian angel would sound like a machine. I guess I should thank you. How'd you do it?
Called in a favor, he says. I have your laptop, which I'm assuming you'd very much like back. I've got a job for you, and if you'll hear me out, I'll return your property.
Even if I pass on the job? I ask.
You won't pass. You've been digging for change in the couch. I'm offering you more money than you've ever seen, and the support behind you not to get caught as you did this evening.
I don't respond, because we both know I'll be there.
I'll text you the address. Be there Monday morning at 9 a.m.
And then the line goes dead. I'd like to say I wasn't curious about the job and had every intention of turning it down no matter what it was, but that would be a lie. When Monday rolls around, I'm waiting down the block just out of sight before the sun comes up. The address brought me to a bail bonds place, and by 8 a.m., there's a steady stream of traffic in and out, which I guess would be normal for an establishment like this after the weekend. I don't like walking into the unknown, and I'm hoping I'll see someone who looks familiar before I'm expected. The voice on the phone gave me nothing to go by. I'm not sure an accent would make it past the voice changer, but something tells me that if he ever had one, he did what I did, spent years wiping away any trace of who I was or where I came from. It wasn't long after I took that first job at the flower shop that I realized my twangy accent created a greater divide between me and the women who came into the store than our bank accounts ever would. The way you walk, the way you talk, the way you move your body screams more about you than anything else ever could. Mr. Smith and I must have crossed paths in the past if I was able to take something from him. Faces, names, places, events, numbers lock into my memory the moment I hear or see them. But as the clock inches closer to 9, I resign myself to going in blind, since the only people on the street are strangers. The squatty brown brick building sits in the middle of the block, with similarly depressing buildings on either side of it. I pull open the door under a blue sign that says AAA Investigations and Bail Bonds. And in smaller letters underneath, check cashing and payday loans. A rush of heat mixed with the smell of sweat washes over me once I step inside. The receptionist points me toward the waiting area after I give her my name. Then she picks up the phone to announce my arrival to whoever is on the other end. Mismatched chairs sit against walls covered in those posters that combine wildlife photography and inspirational quotes, as if a bald eagle knows the first thing about leadership. I drop down in an empty seat between two mostly dead plants. The only other people left waiting are a couple quietly arguing in the corner, and an old man to my right who is hunched over in his chair, snoring loudly. Several minutes later, the receptionist calls my name and points down the hall behind her desk. "Last door on the right," is all she says. I pass 3 closed doors in the narrow hallway before stopping in front of the one she indicated. I take a second or two to center myself, then knock on the door.
"Come in,"
a muffled voice yells. I push the door open and am surprised by the man sitting behind the desk. In my head, I pictured the stereotypical sleazeball, short, balding man, leering grin, cigarette burning in an ashtray nearby. But this man looks the exact opposite of that. He's blonde and gorgeous. He stands when I enter, reaching across the desk to shake my hand, pumping it enthusiastically. His light blue button-down matches his eyes perfectly, and the effect is so dazzling that I know his closet is full of shirts in the same color.
"Luca, good to see you. I'm Matt Rowan."
There's no way to know if this is the same person I spoke with last night, but I'm betting it's not. I nod. "Mr. Rowan?" He throws me a brilliant smile and says,
"Call me Matt. Please, have a seat."
Perching on the edge of the chair, I spy my laptop sitting on the corner of the desk. He notices me eyeing it.
"Go ahead. It's yours, just for showing."
I pull it off the desk and rest it on my lap, fighting the urge to clutch it to my chest. Matt flips a pen and catches it over and over while he studies me.
"I have to say, we've been impressed at the places you've gotten in and out of."
"Who's we? How many creepy guys are in your little gang?" I ask. He gives me a smirk as if he thinks I'm cute. His phone chimes and he slides it off his desk. Matt's thumbs move across the screen at an amazing speed, his attention firmly on his phone. "Is that Mr. Smith?" He ignores me completely. That's fine. I can wait him out. Matt finally looks up from his phone and says,
"We have a job for you. A chance to make some decent money."
"Doing what?" I ask. Matt rests his elbows on the arm of his chair and kicks his feet up on his desk, the phone forgotten for a moment.
"You'll be doing what you're good at. We'll drop you in a situation and you'll get us what we need, without anyone being the wiser. You won't believe the difference it will make with us behind you. I'll give you the details as soon as you tell me you're in."
My mind splits, showing 2 different paths. This is definitely a crossroads moment. Taking the job Matt offers moves me deeper into this world, but comes with the support that would make the feel of those cuffs biting into my wrists a distant memory. The other path requires me to go straight, to get out before I'm in any real trouble. Because as Saturday night proved, it will only be a matter of time before something else goes wrong. Mama always said to be successful in life, you need to do 3 things. Learn everything you can, try your hardest, and be the best at what you do. Saturday night taught me I have a lot to learn. Just thinking about Mama makes my chest hurt, but I shove it down. She's gone, and there's nothing for me in that old life. One day I will go back to being Luca Marino, small-town girl from Eden, North Carolina, who lives in that fantasy house with that fantasy garden. But today is not that day. Today I learn how to make the money I need to make that dream a reality. Okay, I'm in. What's the job?